From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past summer when Governor Andrew Cuomo set a kind of deadline for police reform. The governor asked local communities to come up with their own police reform plans by April 1st or risk losing state funding. In Rochester, the Police Accountability Board is well ahead of that deadline. The board is releasing a wide-ranging policy document with a series of specific points on what reforms can be made and why. Some of those specifics include the banning of the use of tear gas, drastically expanding funding for alternatives to police response, for example, for calls that involve mental health distress. This hour, it's a chance to hear from the board about these proposals and why they believe that actual police reform is achievable for the first time in decades in this community. Our guests this hour include the executive director of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. Welcome back to the program, Connor Dwyer Reynolds. Hi, Connor. Thanks for being here.
Wonderful to be with you, Evan.
Shawnee Wilson is the chair of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. Shawnee, welcome back to the program.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you.
Bob Harrison's a member of the board. Bob, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Reverend Matthew Martin Nikoloff is a member of the board. Reverend, thanks for being with us again.
Great to be back.
Shawnee, let me start with you as the chair of the board here. Why don't you set a little bit of the background for what exactly this document is and how it came to be?
Sure. So we were in compliance with the governor's executive order 203, you know, in compliance after the death of George Floyd. You know, we know that the governor wanted all of these, all the cities of New York State to take a look at the way that they police their citizens and just really have take an in-depth look as to, you know, how policing happens in real time and what changes can be made in order to make the relationship between police and citizens better, and also taking a look at some of the things that are policy and procedure-wise that need to change. And so there was a task force that was developed here in Rochester in response to that order, and the PAB was asked to be a part of that. And so that's how this essentially got started.
And Connor, let me ask you just a little bit about some of those broad outlines before we get into the specifics here. This is a community that is well known for proposed reforms, and I don't want to say half measures. I think for decades there have been sincere efforts, but as our colleague Gino Finelli wrote in City Newspaper a few months back, very little in the way of actual change. What's different now, Connor?
Well, first, you know, the Police Accountability Board is recommending fundamental changes, you know, to our system, having a community-led budgeting process to right-size the RPD and all public safety agencies, drastically changing the way that we deal with first response to crisis calls, changing the way that RPD's culture and training works. But the real difference between the past and the present is that we have the Police Accountability Board. We have an institution committed to fundamental change in the long haul. And if the board gets the resources that it needs to do that job, I have faith that we'll see that fundamental change come to exist in this community.
Reverend Nikoloff, I assume you wouldn't be part of this board if you didn't think it could actually make real change here. Are you confident that that's in the offing here?
Absolutely. I think if the community makes good on its promise to this Police Accountability Board, which is not just having one, but also supporting it, contributing in the dialogue, making sure that it's fully funded up to the level that other civilian review boards are around the country so that we can actually do the work that the people have called us to do. And as we continue to collaborate with other agencies and community groups that are doing great work, the governor's executive order has provided a really great opportunity to work with the Race Commission, with UCLM, with the department and others. So I think not only do we have the mechanism, but we have a great executive director. We have a really wonderful chairperson in Chair Wilson and our vice chair in Dr. McIntosh. And I think we have great people. We have a great community. We have a will to do this, and we have longevity. So I think that this is something special, and I look forward to seeing the work that will start happening even more. I think you'll see a lot of great things starting to happen now that the foundation has been laid.
Bob Harrison, how do you see it?
I think that the real question is whether this board will have the longevity needed to stay the course. And the fact that this has arisen from the community and has broad community support is an important factor that gives me hope.
Well, in maybe a little bit of unusual fashion, I'm going to read an email first from a listener to address a certain point that's come up with parts of our audience before we even get into the specifics, because I know a lot's been happening lately. And Andrew emailed the program to say, how can the board be pushing any changes just days after a Rochester officer was shot in the head? Want to remind the audience the latest reporting from WXXI and news from RPD Chief Cynthia Harriet Sullivan is that the injured officer is doing well, and the chief says that the officer is, quote, definitely lucky or blessed, however you look at it, but certainly I'm really happy that he's not more seriously injured. I'm just grateful for that, end quote. That's from RPD Chief Cynthia Harriet Sullivan about the officer who was shot but is recovering and appears to be doing well. But Andrew says, how can you do this now? So, Connor, let's get that out of the way. I mean, I say get that out of the way. I mean, let's talk about that. Has that impacted anything?
Well, first thing, you know, yesterday, the first thing that we did was we reached out to the department and to the Locust Club to, you know, give our best to that officer and to, because this police accountability board is about the safety of everybody. And, you know, these recommendations reflect that. You know, we talk a lot about officer training, support for officer stress, trauma, hurt. If we aren't addressing that, aren't going to have the kind of public safety culture we need. So this is the right time to be talking about changes to the department, because we need changes to keep everybody safe, officers included.
All right. Well, Andrew, I appreciate that email. And in some ways, what I'd like to do is ask the chair of the board, Shawnee Wilson, to let us know. I mean, I want to communicate to listeners exactly what is in this document. And this is your document. This is your effort to say to the public, this is what we can do. This is what should change. This is why. I mean, I've got my own questions, but where do you start? I mean, how do you prioritize a list of things that you want to make sure people understand about what you're proposing here, Shawnee?
So sure. Yep. So, I mean, you know, we, as you can tell, we have the document is we've made sure that the public can read and understand what's in the document. So, you know, I know that Gino has posted it online and that we also have it posted as well. But, you know, one of the things that we, you know, I'll just talk about some of the core findings that we have in our document so far. And, you know, one of the things I think that we're recommending is that, you know, that we found that Rochester has twice as many officers per resident than any city of our size. You know, that includes crime rates, demographics, and geography don't explain why we're so large. And so we're asking the community to think about that. RPD does engage in a lot of controversial practices. Like, for instance, dozens of people, mostly black and brown, are ticketed this year for things like jaywalking or bells on bikes, which I know that Timothy Doniger brought up in the UCLM discussion that we had outside of their church during the summer, that the RPD really has to take a look at their culture. You know, we have, for instance, officers that are radically different than the citizens they serve. 94% of residents are non-residents within, don't live in Rochester, the city of Rochester. 87% of those officers are white. You know, 87% of those officers are male. You know, many officers view citizens as, quote unquote, the enemy. You know, I know that's debatable and that, you know, that will be have room for discussion is like, but it's like, you know, are citizens considered safe or are they considered not safe, right? I think that from what the community feedback that we've heard, and I think a lot of discussions around the city, that a lot of folks, officers, have issues with racism, misogyny, homophobia, and transphobia. That a lot of these, that there have been a lot of complaints lobbied against officers with those complaints. That a lot of there's definitely a culture problem. That you know, that because of these issues, that really these issues hurt both officers and citizens. And so some of the recommendations that we're asking for is that, you know, that we drastically expand, we talked about mental health as well, that we'd expand for first responder systems that substitute police with social workers. You know, we want to, you know, and I know we can get into a history lesson later, and maybe not in the show, but in another show, but we saw that there was a drastic shift between, you know, how police was dealt with in the 60s and 70s, kind of in the 80s, and now it's dealt with now. You know, we need to have a dramatic shift into how we deal with mental health and actually substitute police with social workers instead. And I know that county is doing that now, right, within mental health and Bella just, you know, that money is now being put towards mental health. We need to support community-led budgeting process, right, to actually size down some of the RPD spending and you know, funnel it into public safety agencies like Human Services, the Fire Department, and the Police Accountability Board. We need to ban high-risk practices like breathing restraints, chemical weapons, sound cannons, and no-knock warrants. We need to boost money for training and response systems that address officer work-related stress and trauma, because stress and trauma not only affect officers, but they affect the citizens in the city. They affect us as well. The release data on policing practices and make other aspects of officer training public, so that, you know, when you're talking about how we're training our officers, we want to know what that means, how that's going. Investigating and begin to dismantle white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, and transphobia in RPD culture. And so we're hoping with community feedback to tie all this up will actually help to give RPD a better, greater understanding about why some of these citizens have these complaints, and then help them to address those issues in real time.
So let's talk about some of the underlying issues that Shawnee just described. Shawnee, I'll start with you, but I'd like all of our guests to weigh in on this. And what I want to ask is about culture. And I want to ask this not from the lens of, I mean, I certainly imagine, you know, Mike Mazzeo would say, well, we don't have a culture problem. What are you talking about? But I'm not asking about this from that lens particularly. I'm asking from the lens of community members who are listening to this conversation, who might think, well, those are very serious allegations. How do we know? So, for example, when you say when you say RPD has a culture issue, when you say that some officers see citizens as the enemy, and when you say that some police are mired by phobias, transphobia, homophobia, racism, sexism, how do you know that to be true? Shawnee.
Yes. So I would say that we do have some community answers that reflect this, that there are some really, as far as the racist allegations, that they are reflecting in our community answers. I would say that, you know, recently when I point to some of the issues that happened a couple of years ago with the RPD and how they dealt with the queer community here in Rochester, that there was a real sense of, you know, that there was a real lack of understanding as far as how people were misgendered, which is they weren't using proper pronouns. There wasn't enough training in regards to how to actually relate to LGBTQ people within the city of Rochester. You know, there have been complaints that are not documented in the community complaints, where, you know, people have definitely talked about being misgendered or being referred to as something very degrading and relates to transphobia and homophobic behavior. As far as misogyny, though, I think I guess I want to be very careful here, because, you know, I think that there's a definite culture of misogyny within the RPD and within police in general that I think that are also briefly brought up in the community answers, where it talks about there being a glass ceiling as far as, like, you know, some women feeling like they're not necessarily being properly heard. And then also just about, you know, do women feel respected within the RPD ranks? That's a question that I would ask. And, you know, I think that these are things that are being talked about in real time within the community, and not so sure in the RPD, but, you know, those are just things that I know that have been in the community for a long time.
Connor Dwyer Reynolds, if it is an officer or a union or just a community member who says, well, I challenge that. Why do you think there is a culture problem? What evidence do you have that there's a culture problem? How do you answer that question?
Well, what I'd say is that it's undeniable that every police department in this country struggles with these cultural issues. And the question is just, what is the extent to which these cultural problems exist in the RPD? You know, Mike Mazzeo openly admits that, you know, there is structural and systemic racism in all of our institutions, including the RPD. You know, the question is, what's the extent? What's the root of these problems? And again, I think the focus from the PAB is seeing these things as structural issues. It's not a matter, Apple, of good people and bad people, bad apples, good apples. It's about structures. How do the policies, how do the procedures, how do the trainings instill some of these perspectives into people? You know, that's really the focus. And I think we do have evidence that these things exist in some way. The next steps and questions are, how do we investigate the existence of these systems, and how do we begin to eradicate them? That's how I think that the PAB is looking at this.
Okay. And Connor, I'm looking at just some of your executive summary. You mentioned that Rochester has twice as many police officers per resident than the average similarly sized city. Is it logical to then say that the PAB feels in general that Rochester has too many police officers?
I certainly think that the question of over-policing is real in this community. We heard it, you know, when we went out and created these answers, we looked to gather community testimonials from folks who are often not heard in governmental decision-making processes, black and brown people, people who are unhoused, people who have a deep experience with public safety, like former police officers, mental health professionals. And we heard time and again, this question about there are, you know, too much of the kind of policing that we don't want. And so when you look at the numbers and you see that, you know, other cities our size, you know, probably have about 300 some odd officers, and we have about 700, I think that raises a question of what are our police doing, and are they doing the things that we want in the numbers that we want them to be doing? You know, we have this new Office of Crisis Response in the city that's supposed to be doing, you know, first responder work. They only about have, you know, 14 or so staff to provide social work for crisis calls. We have over 700 officers. You know, does the community want that? So I think that, Evan, to answer your question, the Police Accountability Board wants these answers out there, wants this information out there so the community can start discussing and say, do we really want, is this the right size for the police department? We want to be posing this information and then get community feedback to answer those questions that you're talking about, Evan.
Okay. Bob Harrison, when you look at the question of culture, do you feel that there's enough evidence to say, you know, pretty plainly that there's a cultural problem in the RPD?
Well, that the first part of that question is easy to answer, but there's a perspective that hasn't been mentioned yet, Evan. You know, yesterday a police officer was shot. And fortunately, the injury seems to have been minimal, and he's apparently well. But in the last month, or just a little over a month, 9 Rochesterians have been killed. 9 civilians have been killed. I would like to see the same expressions of concern, the same turmoil expressed in the police department over the civilians that are killed, that are expressed over the officers that are injured.
Okay. And let me bring in Reverend Nikoloff on the question of culture. I think when you look at it this way, when you think about what is sometimes described, Reverend, as a warrior culture, and I think that that's reflected in somewhat in Shawnee's, in Chair Wilson's comments about the mentality of police officers viewing some citizens as the enemy. We've seen training videos, not necessarily those used in Rochester. I don't know what is used here, but we've seen training videos used elsewhere where police are taught to think of their job as going to war every day. Do you feel it's pretty cut and dry, the question of culture issues in the department, Reverend Nikoloff?
I do. I think that one of the functions of power is to disguise its existence, to try to help people not see that it's there and working in insidious ways. And a white supremacist worldview, whether or not an individual is a white supremacist or a racist, is insidious in its way to infect a culture, infect a community, the way it's infected the entire United States of America, and then to try to conceal its work so that no one can see it happen. So, like, no one, if you asked them, if you said, are you a white supremacist, right? No one would say yes to that answer, and very few people. But like the ways that we fundamentally view the world, the way that we organize this city, the way that we fund different school districts, the way that we have redlined and pursued the ways that we organize ourselves as a society, it is evidence, right, that this is an insidious problem happening. I think some of the greatest perpetuators of trauma against our police officers, ironically, are certain talk show hosts and certain media and other outlets, which perpetuate a novel of police being heroes. I do think police do heroic things, and police absolutely deserve our respect and our gratitude. But continuing to front a narrative in which a select group of suburban residents heroically goes downtown into the bad parts of the area in order to put away those bad people, to protect the good people who also happen to be largely Caucasian and largely property owners not in the city. This perpetuates this notion. And then they come home, right, as kind of conquering heroes or as our defense force. And, you know, you can just see it by driving through Monroe County, right? Downtown, there's very few Blue Lives Matter American flags, with the blue bar across the flag. You start going out a little farther, and there's very few Black Lives Matter signs, right? And there's way more of these kinds of signs. And just that story we tell ourselves, right? We come back to our churches in particular parts of the area, and some churches will say, we need to work on our policing. And others will say, you're a hero, and those people are hurting you, and you're in the struggle against good and evil. So I think that culture is not just perpetuated in a policy way, but it's also perpetuated in the narratives we tell ourselves and which narrative we're telling depending on where we live and what our social location is. So I think it's an insidious thing because nobody is doing it in order to hurt someone else. No one is trying to actively participate in it. But, you know, that's how disease works. It doesn't want to be seen. It just wants to do its work. And I think a white supremacist worldview, a racist worldview, whether or not you actively see yourself as participating in it or perpetuating it, it perpetuates you, man. It wants to find a way in, even if you're completely unaware of it, and it wants to infect the world because it wants to see damage done. And I think those of us, white folks who benefit from it, have the most vested interest in not seeing it, right? We have the most to gain from ignoring it or from trying to find a way to dress it up as virtue rather than just seeing it as what it is, which is a problem that needs to be solved. And I think if we could see it less as a moral judgment upon individuals and more as a existing problem, the same way that we're trying to pursue, say, the coronavirus and looking for a vaccine, looking for policies, looking for ways to inoculate our community against this and then put into place proactive measures that keep as many people safe and help to create as much community as possible, I think we can shift that dialogue away from this moralistic, dualistic warrior narrative that unfortunately, again, is perpetuated by the very people who claim to be defending the honor of police officers. It's actually continuing to place people into this dualistic war, traumatic worldview, which I think does a lot of damage to people rather than helping them to enter into their workplace in a way that they can engage as a human being.
We're talking to members of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. The chair of the board is with us, and the executive director of the board is with us as we talk about the release of a wide-ranging policy document with a series of specific points that they want to see the city of Rochester undertake by the end of 2021. If you have comments, questions, et cetera, about what the board is trying to accomplish here, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I'll take our first phone call, and this is RC. Go ahead, RC.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the current evictions crisis. And just a few days ago, mm-hmm. we saw a massive show of force by the RPD in evicting a family of a mother and three kids, and arresting over a dozen people who came out to support them, including an assembly member, Damon Meeks. The RPD, I assume, acted with on the direction of the mayor. So, you know, this is obviously a citywide problem in terms of leadership. Could you please talk about the eviction crisis and also what you can do as the Police Accountability Board to address this with the RPD immediately in the city? Thank you.
All right, RC, thank you very much. Let me start with the chair of the board, Shani Wilson. Go ahead, Shani.
So I'm actually going to have Connor answer this because this is a logistical question.
Sure.
So Connor, if you can answer this, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Connor.
Sure. You know, the eviction crisis is a threat to this entire community, and we're going to be seeing this come out in waves in the coming months. The PAB is going to be figuring out if and how, you know, it can investigate it, get into this, because, you know, I think if you ask most police officers, I would hope that they would say that they don't want to be involved in this either, that they don't want to be putting people out, especially before Christmas. You know, I think the Police Accountability Board can make this whole process transparent, make clear what the decisions can and cannot be made by the government, who can choose to be what can be done to fix this. I think the Police Accountability Board can play a role in that. We don't speak about that in these answers. But what we want to know from this community is, what do people want us to prioritize in our work moving forward? And so, you know, hearing these things about, you know, how can we, you know, make eviction processes fairer, more transparent, more just, we want to be hearing that from folks. So thank you for that call.
Well, and let me follow up with you on one point that RC was making there, Connor, which is, he said his assumption is that the police are acting at the behest of the mayor. The mayor this past summer spoke about what was happening with Rochester officers during nightly demonstrations in September. The mayor spoke in sort of a detached manner, when a lot of people thought, well, listen, you're the mayor of Rochester. You know, the chief serves at your pleasure. You have a lot of control over what is expected in terms of policy and behavior. In the same way, the mayor spoke about the evictions that RC was talking about and said, you know, New York State needs to do something. I mean, I'm summing up here, but it was a detached set of comments instead of saying, hey, I'm talking to the police and I don't want to see that again. Is that an incorrect analysis here? Do you think the mayor has been detached from police behavior, or do you think the mayor has more of a responsibility, Connor?
You know, I'm not going to say whether or not the mayor has been detached from all this. What I'm saying is that, you know, city government needs to do better on all of this. I think we all agree that. That's why the Police Accountability Board exists. I know Reverend Nikoloff has something to say about this as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, go ahead, Reverend.
Yeah, I think this shows the importance of the need for the Police Accountability Board to be a independent organization, to be able to stand with objectivity around these kinds of issues, so that when we are able to investigate and hopefully use our powers to look into these kinds of matters, we can do so in a way that the community will trust. Because it's clear that right now, despite the best efforts of a lot of our government officials, there isn't a lot of trust. You know, about 5-6 years ago now, a homeless encampment was evicted from beneath the Susan B. Anthony Frederick Douglass Bridge right before Christmas. So I wonder if homeless folks, for example, would feel the same amount of confidence calling up about their eviction, right? They should. They should say, we're being evicted, and why won't the police protect us? The fact that the police protect some people and not others when their rights are being violated, right? Because maybe some people have greater access to property and power than others. Again, not to pass judgment on particular officers, but to note what is happening before our eyes, that the interests of certain groups are more represented than others, and that a police force that exists to serve its people at times needs accountability, which is independent from those interests, which may influence the deployment of that department. It's actually helping to protect those officers as well from doing something that they might think is immoral, but is commanded from somewhere. And so I believe that regardless of the intentions of parties involved, we need an independent and functioning police accountability board, to your point earlier, to ensure that we also enable our officers to do the kind of work that they're actually called to do, rather than being called in as, say, a private security force for a landlord.
But guys, isn't it also fair to say that at the present time, police forces are not well controlled? They are pretty much an entity unto themselves. And one of the things we're trying to do is to get them back under control.
You agree with that, Connor Dwyer Reynolds?
Couldn't have said it better.
Yeah. So what I want to do is, after our only break of the hour, listeners, if you miss some of the specific proposals that the Police Accountability Board is calling on here, I'm going to go down the list, and what we're going to talk about with members of the board and the executive director of the board coming up here, we're going to talk about some of the specific proposals, and we're also going to talk about, you know, if they see these as being achievable. They would like to see the city get this done. Is there movement there? Do they have the support of the mayor? Do they have the support of council? Do they see police officers themselves and those leading the department as amenable to some of these ideas? Or will there be a lot of tension and opposition? I've got some more of your emails to read as well. Let's do all of that after this break. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So looking at the summary of proposals from the Police Accountability Board, here are some of what the board is recommending that the city do by the end of 2021. drastically expand staffing for and use of first responder systems that substitute police officers with social workers and mental health providers, support a community-led process to educate Rochesterians about how the city's limited public safety dollars can be spent, learn the spending priorities of city residents, and develop a budget that reflects those priorities in staffing and funding levels. Create trainings and disciplinary policies that end RPD's use of breathing restrictions, including chokeholds, chemical weapons, including tear gas, protest response devices, including sound cannons, and high-risk practices, including the use of no-knock warrants. Boost funding for training, prevention, and response systems within RPD that address work-related stress and trauma in ways that shield officers, their families, and the people they serve. Make policing transparent by collecting and releasing comprehensive data on the RPD's enforcement patterns, internal culture, and the policing practices, while making public all aspects of officer training. And, finally, protect residents and officers by investigating and dismantling structures of white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, and transphobia that may exist in RPD's culture and practices. Executive Director Connor Dwyer Reynolds, is there reason to believe that that menu of ideas is going to be embraced by the department, by the chief, by the mayor, by city council?
Yes. We wouldn't have made the recommendation unless we think that there's a real shot at this going through. And I think part of why we're confident is because, this has been a process where we gathered the evidence, and now we're asking the community for their feedback. And our hope is that if people speak up and say, these are recommendations that we want, these are some more recommendations beyond those that we've made, that will make it even easier for the PAB to take this as a mandate and say, we're going to stand by this. And, ever since, we released these answers this morning, Evan, and our email's been blowing up with people saying, these are the right answers, or here are some new ones. And I do have faith that this process, this document, is going to show the city that these are common sense changes that we can get done soon.
Is there something on that list that stands out to you that must be done above all others, Connor?
I really think that community-led budgeting process is very important. But to be frank, because that's a way that the community can really gain control over what public safety looks like in this community. But, the thing that I've heard over and over again from people across the community and on this board is culture, changing the culture. And so I think that that's probably the most important recommendation we can make, is making sure that we understand the RPD's culture and root out the problems that are causing so much of what people do not want in policing in Rochester.
Chair Shawnee Wilson, when I look at the question of, for example, tear gas, and looking again at, I'm going to go ahead and read this item again, create trainings and disciplinary policies that end RPD's use of breathing restrictions, including chokeholds, chemical weapons, including tear gas, protest response devices, including sound cannons, and high-risk practices, including the use of no-knock warrants. On the subject of sound cannons and tear gas, for example, these are options that the RPD occasionally deployed during the peak of the public demonstrations following the September 2nd releasing of the information about the death of Daniel Prude. And days into that, you had Mayor Lovely Warren say that she thought the police department had behaved with restraint. You had then-Chief LaRon Singletary say that he thought officers were behaving appropriately and with restraint and only deploying those items when they needed to. In other words, the city leadership was saying they're not out there deploying sound cannons and tear gas for no reason. There are reasons for them to use it. They use it only when they need to. They don't like to do it. They'll do it if they have to. That is clearly not what the PAB is saying. Mm-hmm. You seem to be saying you should not ever be using that. Is that right?
So I know that when our answer says that, only when this force, this deadly use of force is justified, and I think the key word is deadly here, right? I think that what the chief, the former chief, and what the mayor heard and what the citizens are saying are really different. And that is why I need to insert again the need for community feedback in this matter, because it's so important that the mayor and, the now chief knows what people experienced on the ground. There were reports of, people, you know, that we, like, usually with pepper balls, like, you would aim for the feet, you would aim for the legs, not the torso, not the head. You know, we received, there were many reports circulating through social media that people were, you know, having pepper balls being shot at their head and at their chest, right? We had reports of people being, you know, that were people that were seriously injured from pepper balls, right, that had to go to the hospital and have, you know, have urgent surgeries and other issues that happened. I know that there's a lot of different testimonies that will hopefully come out of a community engagement. You know, I think that there is, I honestly think that as a medical professional, that, you know, I would not like to see any of these things used, chemical weapons, restraints, riot control agents not used at all because of how dangerous they are. And I think, you know, when you deploy a pepper ball or a rubber bullet or, you know, tear gas, you know, you have to understand that you have to be responsible for the outcome. And I do not believe, from what I heard and what I saw, that the outcome justified the means. I do not believe so. And so I ask, and this is why we included it in the answers, is that I think that there needs to be a review and a community response and community feedback to RPD about what actually happened from the community, not from the RPD, about what happened and was this use actually justified? And I think that you will get two different answers.
I want to take a phone call from Don and Henrietta on a subject that is right there on the list there. It's about who responds to certain calls. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, Evan, I worked at a local police department for over 30 years as a civilian. And the idea that you're presenting, or the board is presenting, is substituting police with social workers, mental health counselors, cannot be looked at as black and white, one or the other. There has to be a combination of mental health workers working hand in hand with police. I had occasion when I first started out to be in a home where as a social worker walked in and had within about 2 minutes a situation where I was in the basement with a person with serious mental health problems and had a knife standing there with a knife pointing at me. And the only reason I think that didn't end terribly was the police officer that I worked with knew where I was going, knew that person, and said, I think I'm going to swing by and see if he's all right. And I had several occasions like that before it was hammered out that me, being a social worker, needed to be with a police officer when there was going into a place where there was potential for serious violence. The other thing is, when you say you want to just substitute, it kind of degrades the number of police that are excellent at de-escalating situations. And I have been and watched and been with police officers who have taken very, very violent, aggressive people and talked them down and ended it in a way that was to everyone's benefit, including the victim, the person with the problem. So when you talk about we're going to substitute and we're going to have all these social workers instead of police responding, I think a year or two from now, you may be on the radio saying, well, we've had two or three social workers hurt or worse, and what are we going to do about it?
Don,
it can't be one or the other.
So hang there for a second, Don. There's a lot there. And I know that your concerns are reflected by some of the criticism of this idea that it's oversimplifying the question of mental health calls. I'll start with the executive director, Connor Dwyer Reynolds. What do you think, Connor?
Well, I think this is definitely a complex issue, but I also know that our chair, particularly with her experience as a mental health provider, the health provider, has a lot to say about this.
Okay, Shawnee?
Yeah. Hi. So Don Ossley, thank you for everything that you've do as a social worker. You know, I think honestly, social workers are, you know, they are our first line responders a lot in the community. I've worked with them personally and rely on them a lot with the job that I do every day. So here's what I'm going to say. I think, you know, there is no way to simplify or dilute this issue in regards to mental health calls. My only question is, should police be the first responders to said call? That's my question. And the answer that Don was saying was like, you know, I thought, hey, you know, when he was responding, there was a knife being pulled on him. You know, it's like the police officer came because, hey, I thought maybe I should stop by. You know, it was because there was a thought and there was an intent behind that, not just the, you know, just not like just like a push to be a first responder. You know, and I would, you know, if I were out in the field, I would want somebody to be able to keep me safe. And that is completely understood. My thing is that there needs to be social worker plus police officer that is on scene, assessing the scene as it is, right? Figuring out what's going on with the patient, what's going on with the person, and then responding accordingly, not just, and I know, you know, social workers, when we talk about going into homes, which is should be another discussion for another talk, honestly, you know, nobody should go in without a plan. You know, I just think that there should be more of a plan and more intent behind people just going into homes, especially as the police being first responders. Police have been put in a place where they've had to talk down people that are struggling with mental illness. I just think that there needs to be a review of the model and some changes that need to be made. That's just what I'm saying.
Okay. Connor, does that make sense to you?
It makes complete sense. Everything that the chair said is absolutely correct. You know, there's no request here to remove police completely from first responder situations, but we have the data and we've looked at models from across the country. You know, the White Bird Clinic in Oregon actually just signed a contract with the city to help our new first response system kind of borrow from their success. And again, you know, these models where you have social workers as first responders who can call in other people, you know, that I think is what we're looking for.
And if I could jump in.
Yeah, please.
As a clergy person, as someone who's worked in homeless shelters, as someone who's been a foster parent and worked with DHS and with the police in different contexts, and who's married to a teacher who also has worked with police officers in the context of schools, I think one of the major shifts when we talk about shifting police culture that I think would help nuance and respect the nuance of what the caller is saying is that officers need to be able to spend more time in relationship with the people they're serving. When I served in the St. Francis Center in Denver, Colorado, which is 1,500 guests a day coming through that place, right? Pretty chaotic. We had this amazing officer from the Denver Police, Officer Les, who spent 3 days a week just hanging out in the shelter, getting to know folks. And those folks from the shelter would come up to Officer Les at 3 a.m. when they had a problem with their drug dealer and say, help me out. Right? They'd approach him rather than having to wait for him to be called into a hard situation, because he spent time with people developing connections, developing relationships, developing that kind of nuanced understanding, and also working with the staff at the shelter to understand the kind of mental health and substance abuse needs of the guests of that community. So I think in any instance, when people can have relationships with their officers, they're going to be more likely to trust and assist them versus, again, seeing officers as these kind of warriors riding in to, like, you know, dispatch evildoers or people who are harmful. So, you know, I agree. Like, there's some instances that you just need a police officer, and there's some instances where you just need a social worker. And thankfully, in my work as a pastor, I've seen police officers do exceptional work at de-escalation and mental health care. I've also seen not so great instances of that. And I think, in order to increase the likelihood that people will get their right to protection and their right to good policing and their right to good mental health care, part of that is a shift in culture away from kind of a patrol mentality and more towards a relation-centered and person-centered mentality of policing.
All right. Don and Henrietta, I'll give you 30 seconds. Does that at least ameliorate some of your concern?
It does. I would just nix the word substitute. And would say work with, support, coordinate with. You go to a particular call as a team, and sometimes when you get to that call, the officers, perhaps police function would take precedent simply because of the situation that you find. At other times, the social worker, the police officer would take a secondary role and let the social worker really work the situation. But it isn't a either or. It's not a substitute. It's work with, support, and work as a team on behalf of the people that you're working for.
All right. Thank you, Don. Sean, anything you want to add to that point there? Go ahead.
No, I will say this, that I think that the team approach is wonderful, and I thank you for that so much. But I think that the thing that I think that we want to change is that we need actual training around who's the first responder in the situation. Is it going to be the police or is it going to be the social worker? Are they both going to respond? I just think that the process needs to be hashed out. And that also in every single response, there needs to be an actual continuity, right? Where, you know, when you get on scene, if you know the person, you know, then you can respond accordingly and then tell the officer to take a back seat. I just think that from the things that we're hearing in the community, and I know personally as a medical professional that I've heard patients go through, that is not happening. But I also wanted to ask if Don would be comfortable giving us your email, because I really would like to talk to you further, because I really do appreciate your perspective and want to hear more from you.
All right. I don't have Don on the line, but what's the best way for them to get in touch and for Don to get in touch with the PAB, Shani?
So we can give him our, go ahead. Connor, go ahead.
He can email pab@cityofrochester.gov, and we can, at the end of the show, talk about ways people can get in touch with us, give feedback. But, Don, please email pab@cityofrochester.gov.
Okay, pab@cityofrochester.gov. Different Don. I'll kick this one to Bob Harrison. A different Don emails to say, isn't it good for law enforcement to have something in between verbal commands and deadly force? I thought the tear gas, tasers, pepper balls were meant to be in between and not deadly. Does the PAB think officers ought to have access to less than lethal force? And if so, what should it be if not pepper balls or tear gas? Bob Harrison, what do you think?
Well, I think that the problem with pepper balls and tear gas is summed up by something that I've heard before, and that is, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if you have a pepper ball launcher or if you have a tear gas launcher, you're going to use the thing. That's what it's there for. So I like the situation where that decision's taken out of the policeman's hands, and he or she has to talk to the person.
Okay, and let me grab another phone call. We got to keep it tight here. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, perfect. Got just two points. One is around, I love this discussion, and I support the recommendations that I've heard so far. One question I know some folks are going to wonder is, how do we afford this? And I believe one way to look at funding this over time is that if you look at the ratio of police officers per resident in Brighton, the average is somewhere around 1 per 1,000 residents. If you look at the amount of police officers we have in the Rochester city area compared to the number of residents, it's almost 2 to 3 times that amount. And we don't necessarily have 2 to 3 times more crime when we go 15 miles or 15 minutes. And so my recommendation would be, over time, as we have attrition of police officers, we reinvest that into more social workers that can be partnered with, instead of sending 2 police officers to a call, since we know that only 3% or so are violent in nature. You could have a police officer and a social worker. My second point I want to make too is that for the schools that are training our future police officers to incorporate more social work curriculum, so that we can better equip police officers to not just apply the law, but also to understand a little bit more socio-emotional issues, which is going to be 80% of their calls that they have. So those are 2 points I wanted to make, and I thank you for bringing this discussion to the community.
Thank you, Kevin. Connor, about 1 minute. Go ahead.
This is why one of our core recommendations is to have the community say what the public safety budget needs to look like. You know, RPD gets $145 million. Police Accountability Board gets $500,000. The current alternative first responder system gets about $1 million. The community needs to learn these facts and then be able to tell the government what they want. And, you know, just in terms of the policing facts, you know, Kevin gets it absolutely right. You know, we have 3 times more per officers per resident compared to Brighton, Gates, or Greece. In Webster, we have 5 times more officers per resident than we do in Webster. You know, and the community needs to know these facts and decide if it's right. And I'll bump it to Chair Wilson if he has anything last to say with regard to Kevin's fantastic questions.
Okay, Shawnee?
No, I mean, I really just want to stress the need for community feedback, community input. You know, that is what makes the governor's executive order so special, interesting, and the Police Accountability Board doing its work. We are asking for community input as to how they would like to see police work in the city of Rochester. Their voices are important. Their experiences are important for Rochester police to be able to hear them and then respond accordingly.
All right. So in our last 30 seconds, what comes next year? Connor, you mentioned you want to make sure people understand how they can communicate with you, check out what you've put together in this document, and take it forward. What happens next?
You know, you can Google Rochester Police Accountability Board, go to our website, that's, you know, cityofrochester.gov/PAB. The answers are posted there. You can email us feedback, PAB@cityofrochester.gov. There's also a form on our website. You can submit comments. And you can also call into our hotline, 585-428-7524. Again, that's 585-428-7524. Leave us a message. And we're going to be doing more community engagement in January. So keep an eye out, keep an ear out for our work.
Connor Dwyer Reynolds is the executive director of the PAB. Connor, thanks for making the time.
Thank you so much for having us.
The chair is Shawnee Wilson. Thank you, Shawnee.
Thank you, Evan. Take care.
Bob Harrison, a member of the board. Nice having you, Bob. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Reverend Matthew Martin Nikoloff, also a member of the board. Thank you, Reverend.
Thank you.
All right, and listeners, we'll also post links to the document and the website as part of our podcast page, wxxinews.org/connections. You'll find it there if you want to check it out. And our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Won't talk with you until Monday. If you celebrate, hope it is a loving holiday for you. We'll talk to you Monday.